Good day, everyone, and welcome to The Medley. I'm Blake Crash-Priddle, and this week we are in for another double feature. We're going to be talking with two very talented people from Northern Ontario. Our first guest is Kevin Kloss, a country and rock musician originally from Manitoulin Island, who is perhaps best known for his charted single called Erica, which in 1994 was a Canadian Top 40 hit. After that, we'll be speaking with Hap Wilson, a Canadian naturalist, artist, and book author that's committed to protecting the environment of Canada. How were you inspired to pursue a musical career?
Well, in my case, it was two things, really. There was a lot of music in my family. My mother was a music teacher and an accomplished musician, still is. My father was a teacher who was a very, very good amateur musician, and there was just a lot of music in our house all the time. I took piano lessons. The career aspect of it, I don't think I ever really thought that through as such. It was just all I was interested in. So my story is the same as probably many high school kids. I really didn't do well in anything except music. And then once I got a guitar in my hand, that's kind of all I wanted to do. It sort of became my identity. And before I knew it, it was all I really was good at. So I didn't finish high school. I didn't go to university or college. So I was kind of forced to, you know, step up and learn how to do this. And so that's what I tried to do.
Do you have any musical influences?
Influences? Well, I mean, my influences were certainly all the music I was listening to with my friends when I was, a teenager. So, and that would have been all of the rock from the 70s, whether it was Kiss or AC/DC or Judas Priest. So I was like I loved metal and hard rock. And I really became interested in acoustic music probably closer to the end of the 80s. And it just became a focus of mine. I started to really pay attention to songwriters. But my main influence really was an American guitarist singer named Michael Hedges. He was the musician that I really aspired to. His level of musicianship was what I aspired to. Michael Hedges was, and he died very young, but he made some great records, and I got to see him live a couple times. So I would say he's probably my main influence.
I know that you grew up on Manitoulin Island, and that's a place that's known for its folk and country music. Were you inspired by any of the musical scene of Manitoulin Island?
Well, I mean, there was a lot of music going on. It's funny thinking back to what me and my friends would do as like even like 16, 17 year olds, putting a band together, renting halls, putting up posters, selling tickets. I mean, we all started doing that when we were, kids. And so I wouldn't say I was personally influenced by the music that other bands were playing, because we were all cover bands. So everyone was just kind of playing the same songs. There was one band that I think really kind of blew me away. So there was the older kids in my school had a band called Xanthus, and I saw them once at a little teen dance in Mindamoya, and they were just so, to me, they just seemed so professional and so heavy. You know, they all had long hair, they all had platform boots and Marshall stacks, and, probably that was the first real rock band that I ever saw, and I thought, yeah, that's kind of what I want to do. That's how I want to look on stage. I want to be a pro, But there was a lot of music on the island for sure.
I heard that you toured as a supporting musician with Charlie Major's band. What was the favorite part of that gig?
Yeah, well, I really lucked into that. That gig being Charlie's sort of his rhythm guitar player and harmony singer, because I had never really done any kind of big shows like that. I mean, folk festivals have often a main stage, which is pro, and there might be a couple of thousand people there. But I mean, Charlie was a different level. He was so famous, and his, especially out west, his fans were so intense that you know, it was a real eye-opener for me. But I think that the best thing about working for Charlie Major was his songwriting and his performing. Like, I had never really, you know, performed at that level where every song he sang just hit this nerve with his crowd. You know, his whole show was like that. I would say Charlie writes basically 100% hit songs. Incredibly underrated songwriter. And I became like a huge fan. I mean, I not only did I just love the work and loved playing these bigger country shows, but I was just a huge fan of his music right from the get-go. So, yeah, it really made me think about songwriting and performing at that level where you're just connecting with an audience in this really meaningful way.
You're best known for your charted song called Erica. What is the meaning of that song and what's the inspiration behind it?
Erica. Well, I mean, Erica is a funny song. I think that's the second song I ever wrote. Second or third. I mean, when I first started trying to write songs, I had one song that I slaved over for months and months and months trying to get it perfect. And then I kind of had this little acoustic finger-picking part. And it was just a song about a girl who I was dating at the time. You know, just a very basic kind of a love song. But I put that song away. I stopped playing that song. And it was my the woman who became my wife who heard me play it and said, you know, you should dig that song out again. And I changed the name to protect the innocent. And it became Erica. And I'm not quite sure why it struck a chord with the people who helped me make that would have been my third album. But everybody seemed to think we should record that song. And then for some reason, this radio station in Toronto started playing the heck out of it. So yeah, I'm not quite sure what the appeal of it was. It was just a very simple kind of John Denver-y finger-picking ballad.
I know that the pandemic caused a lot of delays with concerts and a lot of concert cancellations. What sort of things did you do to keep busy during the pandemic?
Well, I'm lucky that I have a little home studio of my own. It's not really that much, but, you know, it is my own space. And I just kind of set to work to do stuff in my studio. So, you know, I made a couple of YouTube videos. I recorded two fairly big pieces of music, one a song, the other one instrumental. But yeah, I mean, I just tried to stay focused on playing and singing, even though it was just in my studio at home.
I understand that you wrote a novel. Was that a project that you did during the pandemic?
That was something that I started when I went back to university. So I kind of was in and out of university over the years and finally finished a BA and an MA in history. In 2015 was when I graduated with the master's, and it was just a little kind of a side project, and so I just picked away at that, and then I was lucky. I got a grant, actually, from the Ontario Arts Council to finish it, so it started out just to be just a bit of a fun thing to do, and then once I got the grant, I got to it and finished it up.
I'm familiar with the book, but for our listeners that don't know the name of the book, what's the book called and what's the story about?
Well, the book is called Omaji, and it's a science fiction story. But when I started it, it was kind of an original idea. It took me years to finish it. So by the time it was done, it was pretty common kind of sci-fi trope. But there was kind of a philosophical aim with the story, which was to kind of compare an immortal life inside a computer simulation where all of your desires are always fulfilled, and a human biological life where there's suffering. And the title, when I went to publish it, self-publish it, I was told I couldn't use iLife because Apple actually uses that, or they used to. And so I just called it that because it's a funny word, and so that's what I called it.
I know that there are a lot of authors out there that want to get self-published or published. Do you have any tips for people that want to become a published author?
You know, I think I just kind of looked at writing a novel the same way I looked at doing music. So when I started doing music, I was sending, demo tapes
which were fairly well recorded. You know, they were done in a studio with backing track, you know, with musicians. And right from the start of trying to get a record deal, which was super important when I started, but doesn't mean anything now, I right away thought, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be sending these tapes out to all these people who are just going to send me form letters back saying, sorry, we're not interested. And I thought, well, why would I do that anyway? I mean, I'm writing them, I'm recording them, I'm paying for the recordings, I'm playing gigs. Why wouldn't I just keep doing it myself? And so that's what I did with music. First of all, publishing is quite a bit different. Most publishers are not even going to open a book that they just received in the mail. So you kind of have to, I think, have an agent or have some kind of an in. Ask your family and friends to read it and be very critical and say, this is what I think you should do with this story next, or this doesn't make sense, or look at all these typos, Kevin, you idiot. And only after I had done that and I had it formatted and I was absolutely sure that it was as good as it could be, it was as good as I could make it, then I was comfortable hitting publish, and so that's how I did it.
Yeah, I wrote a novel myself, and I asked a friend of mine to edit it and make some corrections. Needless to say, she didn't call me an idiot. Speaking of songs, do you have any new albums or singles coming in the near future?
No, not really. I mean, I put together a new instrumental CD last year, and I've written one new song in the last few months, but no, I don't really have any plans to do any CDs in the future. It's just a lot of work, and it's a huge commitment to do it. And to be honest, I just don't have the energy anymore. Like I like playing my guitar, and I like doing shows. If I'm asked to do a show, I'm always happy to do it. But it's just too much work to put together like a whole album full of songs and do all the work. It's an incredible thing to take on. So not in the near future, no.
What's the secret to becoming a successful musician?
Success is a weird thing because what people perceive as success always comes down to how much money you've made and how comfortable you are financially. And I mean, they may say that's not what they mean by success, but everyone knows that in this world, that's what success means. The only way you can really approach success is to set, I think, kind of personal, artistic goals for yourself rather than financial goals. I think if you think about it, it's complete and utter luck. That, you know, you can be the most successful artist on the planet and not really have put any work into, you know, your guitar playing or your singing or performing or writing. And so I think, you know, not to rationalize it, I think you have to set those goals. Those are those kind of personal creative goals. Like, then you will feel a success, even if it's only a hobby.
Well, Kevin, I really enjoyed hearing the story about your musical journey and everything else that you accomplished, and thank you very much for coming on the show.
You're very welcome, Blake.
And that was country and rock musician Kevin Kloss. You can purchase some of his music and other merchandise on his website, kevinkloss.com. Next up, here's environmentalist, author, and artist Hap Wilson. How were you inspired to become a naturalist, and how did it lead to your career as an author and as an artist?
Well, it's a bit of a convoluted story, and it goes way back, probably to my childhood. And I think a lot of it has to do with my father was shooting movies for the Department of Lands and Forests. That was back in the 1950s. We had a cottage in the Peterborough area, in the Kawarthas, and he was employing one particular First Nations elder for the movie sets, and he taught me how to orient myself in the bush. When he wasn't on film, he was taking me out into the bush and showing me how to build a camp and, like, light a fire, boil water in a birch bark bowl, and find my way in the bush when there wasn't a trail, and also, you know, canoeing. It was magic in a way, because he said very little, and his communication was mostly in gestures, and I thought that was, you know, that was amazing to me. And it was, like I say, it was like magic. And I, you know, I always assumed that that was going to be my lifestyle, my favorite lifestyle. And that really stuck with me as a, you know, a 6, 7, 8 year old. And from then on, you know, it grew into, well, a passion for one thing. And plus the fact that, I left home fairly early, about 17, and did my artwork. And I had some good contacts in Toronto area. But I was living in a renovated chicken coop north of Toronto, and I would go out and do horse portraits and house portraits and what have you, and create cards, greeting cards, and bar mitzvah invitations, that kind of thing, and making just enough money to grub stake, you know, 4, 5, 6 months of canoeing. And I was, you know, in my late teens and early 20s. I knew that my passion was going to be two things. One was art, and the other was nature and the canoe. And it just seemed to go hand in hand. And it sort of ripened as I got older. I wasn't a good student. I would sooner be outside discovering. You know, my teacher was the great outdoors. And, you know, when I finished high school, I didn't go on to further education. My education came in other ways, and that was to learn as much as I could in the field. And like I say, that became my, I guess, my mantra or passion. And it worked out. It was, you know, not an easy road to take. It was a tough one. I learned a lot by my mistakes, especially in the outdoors, when you're learning to hone these skills, especially in the outdoors. We didn't have a lot of visual aids, and there were not a lot of books in the library about survival. There were some old Boy Scout manuals, that kind of thing. Bradford Angier's Living off the Wilds. Very little in the way of, guidebooks or manuals. And a lot of what was done by just sheer grit and very often by the seat of your pants. And I had a lot of near-death experiences, you know, gaining that knowledge.
One of the books that you wrote is on my reading list, and it's called River of Fire, Conflict and Survival on the Seal River. What's that book about?
It was my first venture north of the typical Canadian Shield country, where, you know, most of the recreational canoeing takes place, you know, in places like Algonquin Park, Temagami, Killarney, Woodland Caribou, all familiar places that, you know, I had paddled for already a couple of decades. And I got together with a young fellow who was very actively involved in the environment movement, along with myself and others, and we decided to, you know, start up this company called the Wild River Company. And we pitched a story to Men's Journal magazine in New York City about the quintessential Canadian adventure story, and that would be on the Seal River, that a lot of people have not really experienced. Back, this is back in the early to midnight, I guess 1994, when this particular adventure took place. And they loved the idea. They loved the idea of doing a story. We went down to New York and pitched the idea to the editors and the publisher of the magazine. And they, it's interesting. They also produced Rolling Stone magazine. Everybody has heard of Rolling Stone magazine, and, you know, right next door to that magazine was the offices of Men's Journal. It was an up-and-coming men's magazine, they wanted this Canadian guide to take their photographer and writer on this crazy trip up in northern Manitoba. And that river was selected for many reasons. One was the geophysical nature of it. It goes from the boreal forest into the Arctic tundra. And the part of the story certainly has to do with the worst wildfires in Manitoba history, up to this point anyway. And there's also the conflict between the government of Manitoba and the federal government and the First Nations, the Saathi Dene people, who were moved off their traditional lands to Churchill, and primarily because of the mining interests and so on going on at the time. And so, you know, part of the story is about the, you know, the trials and tribulations of the Saathi Dene people and moving back to their traditional territory in the 1970s.
You've written a lot of guidebooks over the years, and of course the book about your journey in Manitoba. Are you currently working on any new books?
Well, I've got two new books that I've released in the last couple of years. I'm really proud of them. It's taken each book took 2 decades to put together, and one was one is a historical novel about the Hornby expedition, Dance of the Dead Men. That took a lot of research in period language, the type of gear, and using the diary that was found in the wood stove. When they did discover the bodies on the Thelon River back in 1928, and there's been many books written about the Hornby expedition of 1920. Most of those writings were basic information about the individual characters. About Hornby, and I've taken it further by adding dialogue to the three characters throughout the period that they lived in isolation. And so I've had some similar experiences, you know, wintering in isolation, and I've had really good peer reviews for that book by seasoned outdoors people. And the second book is titled Out of Abaddon, and it's an apocalyptic love story, actually, and really it's a survival guide based on real science and the possibility that the power grid might fail, infrastructure collapse, and society becomes destitute, and who would survive and who would perish, and just bringing all types of different characters from different walks of life and walking them through circumstances. How would we actually deal with an infrastructure shutdown or collapse? And that includes all communications. So a lot of it is believable science that even things that I wrote about 10 years ago within the pages of this book are coming to fruition now. Things like fusion energy.
Have you ever written any other fiction pieces in the past?
No, everything else I've done is all my short story books are based on the real adventures that I've had. That's why I wanted to get away from, I didn't want to get typecast as a guidebook writer. And I did venture off, some time ago into short stories, and then my first attempt at a nonfiction novel was River of Fire, and that I really enjoyed that.
I looked at some of your artwork online, and I noticed that there was some pictures of animals as well as some pictures inspired by the outdoors. Are there any artists that inspired your work?
I always liked Robert Bateman's work because it wasn't super detailed, and I liked the environments that he put his wildlife in. I don't like the really detailed portraiture of animals, and so Robert Bateman, I really liked his work You know, most of my artwork is illustration. So I used to spend a lot of time. I used to go to the McMichael Gallery and look at the Group of Seven work a lot. And a lot of these artists started as illustrators and commercial artists before they got into actual paint medium. And I really liked working in black and white because I find it more challenging. You don't have the color to accentuate tone work. You have to work tone basically using one color, which is black.
What's the biggest piece of advice that you would give to somebody that wants to follow your footsteps, become an environmentalist or writer? Or
I think patience is one thing. Listening to people and listening to other professionals. I had some good mentors. I had Farley Maud was actually a mentor of mine. He looked at two or three of my manuscripts, gave me some good advice. Editors that I've done articles for in my early days of writing and art, you know, they would critique my work. And if I was discouraged by that, certainly there's an element of discouragement, but there's also that element of having to learn something to make what you do better. And I took that to heart. I took criticism and utilized that to, you know, better my work and to not to be angry that, well, you know, if you don't like my work, that's tough, you know. That's, I think, how I managed to survive in this business is, you know, you do your part. You know, I feel obligated to and happy to, you know, do my bit, whether it makes a difference or not. I hope it does. And we do what we can do. You know, that's the best we can do. And that's, you know, I don't hide my head in the sand. I'm a fighter. I've been, you know, on the front lines of the environment business for decades now, and a couple of times I burned out. I've seen compatriots in the environmental field burn out as well, because, you know, we ride on our passions, and sometimes we get carried away, and we forget that we also have to raise families and run a business, and a lot of environmental business is pro bono. We don't, as a director for our agency, we don't get paid for the time we spend on fighting these campaigns. I don't get paid for the research that I do for my guidebooks or do the research for my novels. Sure, I get a pittance for royalties and that. I wouldn't make a living on it. If I didn't have, you know, other businesses, but like I say, I do my part, and my wife and I are very happy in educating people. I do that through my art, my writing, and we continue to do that at our eco lodge in Temagami. We have, you know, hiking trails, and people go up there to reconnect with nature and learn things about First Nations and, you know, learn things about the logging industry and how it's changed over the years. And it's nice to see nature through someone else's eyes when you tell them a story or you explain something to them.
What's the most important part about creating established trails?
We're doing it sustainably, low impact. You know, most people just think trails happen. And don't understand, you know, the amount of work. It is rocket science in some ways. I think the fact that you have to take into consideration the sensitivity of the land. And the nice thing about hand-built trails is that it doesn't disturb the ground mat. And this is something that we still haven't got a handle on the effects of, for example, clear-cut logging on, you know, the surface environment. There's a real connectivity to the forest. And if we go in with hand tools, we can carve, we can surgically place a trail in the environment. Whereas a lot of trail building or so-called trail building companies use excavators and tear up the roots, and that connectivity is lost. So this is something that we're very cognizant of when we design a trail, and taking a lot of consideration, sensitive vegetation, nesting sites, that kind of thing.
Well, Hap, we really enjoyed having you on today, and we wish you all the best of luck going forward. And it seems like you've had an amazing career, and I commend you for all your hard work.
Well, Blake, it's my pleasure, and thank you.
And that was artist, environmentalist, and author Hap Wilson. You can find out more about Hap's work, as well as more information about the two companies that he has, on his website, hapwilson.com. That's our show for this week, and don't forget to follow The Medley on Facebook. Until next time, here at The Medley, we're all kinds of different.